It's dumped. It can go anywhere. This is January 22, I believe. Is that correct? And we're looking at chapter 22. And let's see here. Anybody in here 22 years old?
I am.
Ah, Ken is 22 years old. So we go just full of twos today. Oh, you're 22? No. Soon? All right. Well, anyway. And there's 22 questions on this quiz I'm giving you today. No, I'm kidding. Anyway, so there is one. This glucosalanine cycle is very. Sometimes, you know, this is talking about the Cori cycle is galactate being dumped into the blood and going to the liver. But there's another cycle called the glucosalanine cycle that's almost identical to this, except for the fact that it's dumping alanine. Can you fit alanine in there? Alanine into the blood, and that alanine then goes to the liver and then comes back out as glucose. And that's called the glucose-alanine cycle. The nice thing about that is that alanine carries ammonia. It carries NH3. Carries NH3 to the liver. Huh? What? Hello? Huh? Well, when you look at pyruvate, the structure of pyruvate, the structure of pyruvate is CH3, C double bond O, C double bond O, O minus. In other words, a physiological pH, it's ionized, it's a pyruvate ion. The only difference between this and alanine is this following molecule. I mean, it's just you've got, I'm running out of space here, but... In other words, alanine is simply pyruvate with that carbonyl group replaced with the nitrogen, NH2. Do I need to turn the light on? Can you see that? So this is what happens in the muscle. The muscle will take the pyruvate that it's getting out of the out of glycolysis, and rather than shunting it into lactate, it moves it over to alanine, and then that goes across. And the advantage here is that it gets rid of ammonia. And this is coming from a glutamine pool. Glutamine pool that's in the muscle tissue. Because the muscle can also use protein for energy. And it does use protein for energy. And so... the protein has to have its nitrogen removed before the carbon skeletons can get into the glycolysis or citric acid cycle. And that ammonia, that nitrogen, ends up in a glutamine pool. And that glutamine pool is a source for the ammonia that gets put onto the pyruvate, which ends up going to the alanine, which ends up going to the liver. Now, what happens in the liver? Well, the alanine, the nitrogen gets peeled off, and it gets captured as urea. Urea. I just met a chemical named urea. No? Doesn't ring a bell? Name the musical that came from. West Side Story. Yes, indeed. I apologize for that. It's so early in the morning. What? Yes, it is, exactly. I gave one away. You know, what it... that musical, it was, you know, Beauty and the Beast, Beauty and the Beast, West Side Story, Beauty and the Beast, never mind. I'm just prattling on. So the urea then, of course, then, this gets captured as urea cycle and then gets dumped into the blood and gets filtered out by the kidneys, and that's how you get rid of your nitrogen, in part. At least as it comes from the muscle tissue. So you have now two cycles that enable energy equivalents to move from depleted energy equivalents to move from the muscle to the liver, get reestablished as high energy or higher energy compounds, and get dumped back into the blood and used for a variety of purposes. The Cori cycle and the glucose-alanine cycle. Are there any questions about this process here? Does it make sense? Yes, it should. Yes, it should. Okay, well, let's go ahead then, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? We've been talking about gluconeogenesis. Obviously, these are both occurring in the cytosol because that's where the enzymes for glycolysis is, and that's where the enzymes for gluconeogenesis are, except, of course, for pyruvate carboxylase. When the energy status is high, glycolysis should be turned off, and pyruvate should be used for synthesis and storage of glucose. Energy status is low in the cell, glucose should be rapidly degraded to provide energy for the cell. The regulated steps of glycolysis are the very steps that regulate the reverse direction, not surprisingly. So you can see here that, for example, let's just circle a couple of them that make sense here. Especially phosphofructokinase and fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase. This is truly the central. This is where the vast majority and one of the most important regulatory steps are. And so, of course, fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, as we remembered from first semester. If you weren't here first semester, you ought to come drop by and see me. I need to give you that little handout that I had for that. And we ought to go through and explain it again. I ought to just explain it again anyway. Let me just see. Isn't that awful? Here the guy just takes off and starts going off. And let's see if I can find this thing. I see if it should be on here somewhere. 2-6. Let's see. Is there any 2-6s? No. What else would it be? Let's try fructose. Oh, that wouldn't be there. Fructose. Anything? Oh, in the contents. I'm looking for the file name. Anything in fructose? Name matches that? Apparently not. Let me try that again. 2-6. No, still not that. All right, it's not here. So we'll just have to. I'll try to get to you on Monday. I think I mentioned this earlier, didn't I? I was going to try to do this today, and I failed to do it. We need to go through that. At any rate, so for everybody back online. So fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, and this. So notice here, it stimulates glycolysis. Notice it stimulates the phosphofructokinase, so it stimulates glycolysis. Same. Concentration inhibits fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, which would inhibit gluconeogenesis. So this thing stimulates glycolysis, inhibits gluconeogenesis. AMP stimulates glycolysis, it inhibits gluconeogenesis. So when fructose 2,6-bisphosphate is low, that means glycolysis is not stimulated, and it means gluconeogenesis is not inhibited. Get that? Not inhibited. What's another way of saying not inhibited? Activated, yes, indeed. It's a double negative, isn't it? AMP stimulates this to be turned on. When this is at a low level, this is not being turned on. And also at a low level, AMP is not being turned off. Again, not being inhibited. So this is the crucial thing right here. Now, of the, let's see here. So I need for you to know the regulation of gluconeogenesis. So I want you to know those three regulatory small molecules. Don't worry about the glucose-6-phosphate. That means that low levels of F2-6BP stimulate, or at least de-inhibit, AMP de-inhibit. Low levels high levels of acetyl-CoA turn on the pyruvate carboxylase. All right. So, okay. What else? Let's go ahead. Let's see, allosteric and substrate control. Glucose-6-phosphatase is under substrate level control, not allosteric control. What does that mean exactly? Substrate level control. What?
Depends on the concentration of substrate.
Right. Which is an odd thing, which means that there's more. If there's more substrate here, it simply gets turned on. So it really is almost like a. It's almost like a feed-forward activation, as it were. Pyruvate depends on acetyl-CoA, as you see before. The bisphosphatase inhibit AMP activated by citrate, although it doesn't show citrate here. It says activated. 1,6-bisphosphatase is activated. Okay. Because they don't show substrate here. They don't show citrate here, I mean. So fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, allosteric inhibitor of F1,6. So, again, someone send me some email to remind me by Monday to bring in that metabolic pathway for fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. You'll remember it from first semester. Here's evidence that this works this way. Let's see here. Fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase activity. This is the gluconeogenic activity. So when this is turned on, gluconeogenesis is turned on. And you can see here that when you have high levels of 1,6-bisphosphate, it is inactivated. And when you have low levels of 1,6, it's activated. Fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase activity. What does this all mean here? Okay. My fructose 2,6, an absence and presence of 25. Oh, I see. Oh, okay. Here. The key here is, under normal circumstances, let's see. These numbers right here is the concentration of the 2,6-bisphosphate. The controlling material. That's this stuff right here. Ding, ding. So these numbers right here indicate the effect of this kind of concentration on the activity. And you can see high levels of this activity, high levels of this compound inhibit this particular activity. And so you can see that right here, where high levels of 2,6-BP inhibit the phosphatase. That's what this is saying. So this is evidence. This is it is the raw evidence, the data, that enables them to say this kind of compound, as the concentration of this material goes up, the activity of that particular enzyme drops. And you see, with none of it, high level, little bit more, indicated in what's concentration, millimolar, 25 millimolar, or micromolar maybe, it's greatly inhibits that activity. Let's see here, what else is this? The B, the substrate, once at concentration, I'm not going to worry about that. And then see the effect of AMP on the inhibition. So you can see here again that the combination of the 2,6-bisphosphate concentration going up and the AMP concentration going up really hammers that this enzyme right here, this thing. And that's what this line is trying to say. As you increase the 2,6-bisphosphate concentration, it lowers, and also as you increase the AMP concentration, it even lowers it even more, so that the double whammy of these two values going up simultaneously really inhibit the relative activity of the pathway. All right. Now, figure 2213 is a really awkward diagram of what I'm going to show on Monday. So I will give you a hint of what this is. This is a diagram that illustrates a single enzyme produces and destroys or degrades fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. Let me repeat that. This is a diagram that demonstrates or illustrates the fact that a single protein has two different activities on it. A single protein can both create 2,6-bisphosphate and destroy or remove, change 2,6-bisphosphate. Notice it says this. Synthesis and degradation of 2,6-bisphosphate are catalyzed by the same bifunctional enzyme, a single protein that has two enzyme activities on the same chain. Hold it. One end does one, another end does something else. One end is called PFK2. PFK2. Guess what that PFK2 stands for? Two. Well, what's if PFK, if If PFK2 stands for phosphofructokinase 2, what's phosphofructokinase 1? So under here, you see where it says phosphofructokinase? Write in the abbreviation PFK-1. PFK-1. So in other words, or you can say phosphofructokinase equals PFK1. But PFK2, very tricky, PFK2 produces F26BP. F26BP. Guess when they discovered F26BP? This is a sugar. It's just like 1,6, except it's not on the first carbon, it's on the second carbon. It exists in micromolar amounts in the cell, and yet has a very powerful control over glycolysis and gluconeogenesis. F26BP. This was discovered in 1975 or 1976. Something so fundamental as that simple carbohydrate wasn't discovered till I graduated from college. Wow, who knew? We all thought we knew everything back then. The more we investigate life and biology and biochemistry, the more we discover we don't know anything. The more there is to discover. All right. So one enzyme represented by that pink bar with two activities. The first activity, PFK2, produces F26BP. And we can see there it stimulates glycolysis. You can write in and see where it says PFK1 say stimulates glycolysis. And where it says it's got a negative 1,6-BPase, inhibits gluconeogenesis. So it stimulates glycolysis, inhibits gluconeogenesis. If I was this particular person who drew this diagram, I would not have drawn it like this. But at any rate, that's okay. So what did I say about PFK? What does F26BP do to PFK1? Stimulates it. What happens at 1,6-BPase? What does it do? Inhibits it, but that means it inhibits what? Gluconeogenesis. Okay, we've reviewed that. Now, what if we want to turn that off? What if we want to turn off PFK1 and turn on 1,6-BPase? What does that mean we have to do to this compound? We have to degrade it, don't we? We have to get rid of it. Well, how do you get rid of it? Well, turns out that this enzyme can be covalently modified with a phosphate. Notice ATP to ADP, there's a phosphate on here. And I want you to note here, this F26BP is here. Here's the other F26BP. So if you have F26BP in the cell and this activity is turned on, then F26BP is used to make, it's broken down, making an inorganic phosphate and a fructose 6-phosphate. So the question is, what changes, what takes that enzyme from being a F26BP creator to an F26BP destroyer? And that's what we'll discover with a little better diagram on Monday. Okay, just hold on to your hat. All right, how are glycogen and starch catabolized in animals? What's catabolism? Are we breaking it up or building it? Are we building it up or breaking it down with catabolism? Breaking it down. Alpha amylase is an glycosidase. That's endoglycosidase. Let's say that together, shall we? Shall we practice saying complicated biochemical enzymes? Endoglycosidase. Say it.
Endoglycosidase.
There you go. All right. Alpha amylase. Now, there turns out to be a salivary amylase, and there's also a gastric. They call it gastric alpha amylase. And you can also find intestinal alpha amylase. Endoglycosidase. Well, let's parse this word. The ace means it breaks it apart. Glyco means we must be operating on a what? some carbohydrate polymer. And the endo means it does what?
It's on the inside.
Yeah, it cuts it in the interior, not from the ends. Okay, you know, remember Pac-Man? Well, that would be an exo. What?
This time Pac-Man can only cut from the
inside. Exactly. Pac-Man can only cut from the inside. That's exactly right. It cleaves amylopectin or glycogen. Amylose or dietary amylopectin or glycogen to maltose. See, I don't... There are two forms of starch. Amylose and... What is that? Amylopectin. Which one is in fact completely linear? The amylose or the amylopectin? Amylose. What's amylopectin? It's actually highly branched. So the alpha amylase, I think it's a bit of a misnomer that it whacks on the branching pieces of starch. It actually acts on the straight chain pieces of starch, but I'm not going to quibble. The problem with this is glycogen is so highly branched. Anyway, it produces maltose. Of course, maltose is what? What maltose is that? A monosaccharide, a disaccharide, a trisaccharide, a pentasaccharide? What is it?
Disaccharide
made up of what two monosaccharides? Or what two units? What is it? Glucose and? Well, it's glucose. Right? Just made up of glucose. So when you said glucose, I should have said, yes, you're right. But I was looking for two because it's a disaccharide. Glucose. Guess what maltotriose is? What do you think that is? Three of them. And other small oligosaccharides at any rate. So it's active on either side of a branch point, but activity is reduced near the branch point. Debranching enzymes cleave these, limit dextrins. Note the two activities, the debranching enzyme. What are we going on here? Okay, so what happens here is, okay, so what you got going on here is you got your glucose polymer. Glucose polymer. And so you got noom. And you got noom, doom, 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 doom. Which one's amylose? Which one's amylopectin? Top one is amylose. Bottom one is? Yeah, this can occur. These can both occur in starch and glycogen. Glycogen is the animal form of carbohydrate storage. Starch is the plant form of carbohydrate storage. The amylase only cleaves linear. So boom, 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 boom. Maltose, maltotriose, some kind of thing. Okay, but it can come in here. Dun, 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 dun. It chokes. It has trouble right here at these branch points. It chokes because it can't get in there. It's too big. So you end up at the end of this, you have a bunch of maltoses and maltotrioses, but then you got these things, the branches that the amylase can't get to. These branches, these segments of branches, not surprisingly, are called limit dextrins. Huh? Well, it's an old term, but it's stuck. Limit dextrins. Well, why? That's dextrins because it has to do with it, it's pieces of sugar, dextrin, dextrose. But the limit means, why do you think there's a limit? Well, because the amylose can only get so far before it's limited. So it's limit dextrins. That's why it's called that. Now, how do you deal with this? Well, we'll get to that in a little bit. It's active on either side of branch point, but activity is reduced near the branch points. The debranching cleaves limit dextrins. No two activities debranch. I don't know. Will they say that anywhere? Where is, in fact, I don't say. It doesn't say here. All right. So We got to go back through here. Are you ready? We're gonna talk about these lipodextrins and debranching and all this kind of thing. There is an enzyme. There is an enzyme that's got two. Count them, two. Let's take a lipodextrin. Lipodextrin. Okay, and we get like this. You got the debranching enzyme. Debranch. Debranching enzyme. And what it does is it takes. It takes a segment of that one branch, like this. Don't go all the way to the corner, just leave the corner. Okay? It takes this and moves it over here. So you end up something that looks like this, where this piece of it came from over here. Okay? That's step one, debranching activity number one. Two activities in that debranching enzyme. The second activity of the debranching enzyme, and it's on the same enzyme, it's on the same chain, takes that thing and breaks, it breaks that bond right there, that one six link, it breaks. And so you get this and that, then you have nothing but amylose at the end. So the branching enzyme moves a segment from one to the end, and the next step is to break the last glucose that's there to make a free glucose. This is one glucose, by the way. This is one glucose right there, one and only one. And the second activity, the branching enzyme, cleaves that off, and then you got amylose, and then the amylase can come in and start chopping it up like a Pac-Man. So that's what they're talking about here. Debranching enzyme cleaves lipodextrins. Note the two activities of the debranching enzyme, and somehow either I dropped it accidentally or they forgot to put it in. So that's what that debranching enzyme does. All right, we got to go on. Metabolism of tissue glycogen. Digestive breakdown is unregulated 100%. What in the world does that mean? Okay. When it says digestive breakdown is unregulated 100%, it means you as a chemotrope, I believe is the term, consume complicated molecules. Very complicated molecules. But you absorb simple ones. You only absorb simple ones. So between the complicated molecules that you absorb and like to eat and the simple molecules that your bloodstream actually accepts, there has to be a digestive breakdown. That means that if you eat a donut, which is composed virtually 100% carbohydrate, by the time it hits your gut, it is 100% broken down. There's no regulation in digestion. It's go for it. It's completely aggressively break it down. You go and have a big Whopper at Burger King, and you decide to have it with meat. And you have these complex proteins that come with the meat. Okay? The meat is muscle protein. Myosin and actin and all the troponin and all that kind of thing. Well, the body doesn't go, oh, look, there's a myosin molecule. I'll just take it, absorb it from the tissue, haul it around, and place it right in my muscle. Okay? It doesn't do that. When you eat beef, pork, when you eat anything that's got that kind of tissue, that's not what happens. The body takes it and breaks it all the way down to the amino acids, imports it, and rebuilds it as you. Not part, you know, I had some cheese protein yesterday, and I had some fish protein, and I had some soybean protein today. And so I've got, my leg is made of fish protein, and my other leg is made of soy protein, and this arm is made out of, where did I get, tofu protein. No, it breaks it down completely. Now, it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it, that I would hammer this. But you can't believe number of people who come to me and go, I'm on this wonderful diet. It's a, what do they call it? Raw diet? It's a raw diet. I don't eat any cooked foods. The food temperature can't get above 125 degrees or something like that. I don't know why they arbitrarily pick some number. It's kind of stupid. But anyway, that's because I want all the enzymes to be fully active as I eat them. Sounds really good, doesn't it? You want vital enzymes. You need, you know, all that kind of thing. The only problem is, guess what? Those enzymes are made out of what? Protein. Protein. Those enzymes are made out of protein. As soon as that protein, I don't care how carefully you prepare it, how carefully you manage to make sure every enzyme in that plant material is fully active as you bite on it, as soon as it hits your stomach, what does it do? Gets digested. It gets broken down how much?
Plus, you know, the pH in your stomach is very low. That's also going to be nature of the enzyme.
Oh, it's going to whack it. It's going to whack the thing.
Yeah, so even if you don't cook the enzyme, it will still be denatured.
Right, and completely destroyed. The in other words, the fallacy is that active enzymes are better for you than inactive enzymes. The body goes, I don't care. I'm going to activate it, deactivate it anyway. You know, cook it if you wish. Don't worry about it. The advantage that they have is that that kind of raw diet has two primary advantages. One, it's very healthy. There's hardly anything in anything that they eat that could even remotely be construed as harmful for you. If you don't eat meat, you know, you are, and you eat these very fresh, you know, raw vegetables and stuff. You are consuming, you know, as pure a food stuff as you can get. No harm in it at all. The other thing is, you can hardly get enough calories to gain weight in it. If you're eating raw vegetables, raw fruits, raw that, you have to eat all the time, especially if you're active. Because there's that kind of, there's not much energy density in it. Now, there's a lot of energy density in nuts. Why is there a lot of energy density in nuts? Because nuts have lots of oil. That's right. Not fat. You're a good, see, oil. Why do nuts have oil? Well, they're plant material. Only animals produce fat because it has to be liquid at room temperature for plants or they can't move it around. At any rate, so it's a wonderful thing and they're going to be healthy and they're going to think it's because they were protecting the enzymes, but you and I both know that by the time it gets out of your stomach, there's not an enzyme alive in there. Now, let's just think about this. Would you want an active enzyme being imported into your blood? Well, probably not, because honestly, you're also eating, I don't care how carefully you prepare food, you're also consuming bacteria. Tons and tons of bacteria every day are being swallowed. Bacteria that's in between your teeth, bacteria that come, just you breathe in and there's dust in that on the air, and it gets trapped in your mouth and you swallow it. If those enzymes and those bacteria were allowed to be imported in total into your bloodstream, you'd be sick all the time. Enough me ranting. So, just when someone comes up to you later and you're a chemist, you're a biochemist, can you tell me about the advantage of this, that, or the other? You just smile and say, you like it, and I don't see any harm in it, go right ahead. But, you know, and if you really want to be bold, just tell them, I'm not so sure the enzymes, need to be all that active when they get to your stomach, because by the time they get there, not much going on afterward. All right, yeah, anyway. But tissue glycogen is an important energy reservoir. The breakdown is carefully controlled. So I'm saying once the digestive system breaks it all down, right to the very minimum, okay? To the fundamental building blocks of the fundamental building blocks of all the major polymers. breaks down the amino acids down, proteins down to amino acids, breaks down the carbohydrates down to glucose, fructose, galactose, all the monosaccharides. There's very little, although there is, there's very few, very little disaccharides floating in the bloodstream. It's all monosaccharides. And the fats are all broken down into the fatty acids and into glycerol. Okay, tissue glycogen breakdown is important, energy reserve, but that's not what's happened once the energy is in your body. The control of the energy within your body is fairly carefully regulated. So tissue glycogen is an important energy reservoir. Its breakdown is carefully controlled. Glycogen consists of granules of high molecular weight. Glycogen phosphorylase cleaves glucose from the non-reducing ends of the glycogen molecules. This is a phosphorolysis, not a hydrolysis. Metabolic advantage product is a sugared phosphate, a sort of glycolysis substrate. That's actually glucose 1-phosphate is the immediate precursor out of that. What's glycogen look like? And what's a non-reducing end and what's a reducing end? Do you remember that from first semester? What a reducing end and a non-reducing end is of a polymer. Here you got glucose, 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 glucose. And this is, it's always written, so this is the non-reducing end. And this is always the reducing end. And glycogen has glycogenin in the middle of its molecule, glycogenin in the middle of its molecule, and there are branches coming off from this of glycogen. The branches have the there's branches and there's branches of the branches and there's branches of the branches. There's branches of the branches, branches of the branches, branches of the branches, branches. In other words, you get this very complicated thing in which these all sticking out here are non-reducing ends. Everything's sticking out. You remember what, ever seen a Kush ball? You know what a Kush ball is? It looks like it's made out of millions of rubber bands that are cut off and just have the ends sticking out. They're a soft ball, but you can stretch it and pull it. It just looks like a sphere of hundreds of things pointing out. Kush ball? Doesn't ring a bell? Oh, I can hardly describe it. Anyway, that Kush ball, if I can find one, I'll bring one in. Kush ball, all the ends are the non-reducing ends of this carbohydrate. Non-reducing ends. All the ends are non-reducing, and that's where glycogen phosphorylase attacks. It attacks at these ends, chomp, 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 again, like a Pac-Man kind of a thing. So glycogen phosphorylase cleaves glucose from the non-reducing ends of the glycogen molecule and produces glucose 1-phosphate. All right, this is now a little different. This is how glycogen is formed, glycogen synthase. It forms 1,4 glycosidic bonds of glycogen. Glycogenin forms the core, as I mentioned right here. Here's a glycogen. It's much smaller than what's here, proportionately. The first glucose is linked to a tyrosine, and then glycogen transfer synthase transfers glucose units from UDB glucose to a hydroxyl group non-reducing end. There's this thing. So here we go. Where are we here? This is. I really don't care about the mechanism of this thing, but what happens is that when you're making glycogen, the compelling energy process that does this is UDP glucose. This is a high energy glucose unit. We haven't talked about where you make UDP glucose, but suffice it to say you make UDP glucose, and then as glycogen and glycogen synthase use that high energy glucose, it comes on and adds in a 1,4 bond at the non-reducing end. And so you have glycogen, this polymer of glucose. Here's the new glucose being added. That glucose is being added from a high energy UDP glucose. UDP is removed and recycled. And then you have now glycogen that's one more longer. But the high energy precursor to making glycogen, extending the polymer by one more glucose unit, is UDP glucose. That's the high energy substrate that's necessary for that. And I guess we're going to have to quit. Enzyme cascades. And we're nearly done, but man, not quite. All right. It's all interesting, but it just takes a long time. You should now have in your hand chapter 23 and 24. If you have not begun to read chapter 22, please